From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for the Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Allison Silberberg. She is the mayor of Alexandria and a candidate for re-election to that post. Joining us in studio now is Alyssa Silverman. She is an at-large D.C. council member. She is an independent. Alyssa Silverman, good to see you.
It's great to see you, Kojo. I thought you guys forgot about me.
No, we never forget about you. We just don't want you here too often. Tom Sherwood, let's talk schools. First, in Prince George's County, three of the school board members, generally seen as a kind of dissident faction of the school board in Prince George's County, say that several Central Service employees, according to the Washington Post, received unauthorized raises, even as their proposal for a teacher pay increase of 4% was rejected. The story seems to depend entirely on the word and knowledge of those three board members, but it simply adds to a scandal in which test scores and grades were allegedly manipulated, charges coming from those same board members, then later being investigated by the state itself.
Well, we can still find out more about who got the raises and why, because that's pretty clear. But the larger issue is, in fact, the graduation scandal that's 5,000 students maybe had their grades adjusted so they can graduate. It's a real embarrassment, and of course, it's seeped over in, or rushed over into the governor's race, and that Larry Hogan, who's seeking re-election, was out of the box quickly to say that the school superintendent Mackle should resign, that their state board, Maryland state educators, put an employee into the school system.
Another gubernatorial candidate is calling on him to resign.
I was going to say that this is not just Hogan, but Ben Jealous, who's also running against Rashern Baker, among other candidates for governor, has called on the Baker to fire Kevin Maxwell, the school superintendent. Rashern Baker, staff and campaign have said, you know, Jealous, it's nice that he's showing interest in the schools, but this is purely a political move on his part to get into the story, and that Sharon Baker says Maxwell has done a good job of moving the schools forward and they'll fix whatever issues there are in place.
Well, there are those who feel that this can be a stumbling block in Rashern Baker's candidacy for governor of Maryland. One wonders whether a similar stumbling block can occur in the District of Columbia, in which there have been school scandals, another situation in which the mayor is in control of the school system. And during the course of this past week, another mini-scandal, if you will, some think it's more major than mini, in which the former school's chancellor, Antoine Wilson, said that Mayor Muriel Bowser knew well in advance of her meeting or her discovery that the inspector general was investigating whether or not the school's chancellor and the deputy mayor for education had gamed the school system, had gamed the lottery system, in order to get the school's chancellor's daughter into a different school. The mayor says absolutely she did not know before that. Council Chairman, Education Committee Chairman David Grosso said he would call a hearing. Wilson said he would be willing to testify. The mayor said, I am definitely not testifying before this. And before we knew anything, the Council Education Committee Chair decided to call off the hearing entirely, saying that he was going to focus on, I guess, the real problems in D.C. public schools. What's going on?
Did we put out a scorecard or a guide to all this, you just said? I just want to finish Prince George's by saying Rashern Baker has been leading all the polls for the Democratic nomination. And so the school thing is a perfect target for other people trying to derail his bid to be governor.
And in the District of Columbia, the mayor is presumably leading all the polls because she doesn't, at this point, have any significant opposition.
You know, we had in the city, and we'll talk to Alyssa Silverman about
big
this.
Big time.
Wonderful.
But in a moment. But, you know, the chancellor, after he got his $140,000 severance pay from the mayor, said he didn't like the fact that he was being seen as having hidden this decision to transfer his daughter from the mayor that he alleges he told her last fall. I must say, I did speak to the chancellor. It was more of a background conversation where I just asked him about it. It's not clear to me exactly how he told the mayor. It sounds like it may have been in passing. There may be some reference to his daughter who was having trouble in one school. But it didn't sound like to me that he informed the mayor that he and the deputy mayor, Jenny Niles, were taking the affirmative steps to transfer his daughter from one school to another in violation of the very system that the Chancellor Wilson had put in place at the mayor's request. So the mayor says she learned about this only in early February, fired the deputy mayor for this, or asked the deputy mayor to resign, and then had the chancellor resign when things got out of hand. So we don't know what happened. And then I thought it was going to be great. David Grosso, the chairman of the Council Education Committee, spoke up and said, I'm going to call them all in, have them testify under oath, that this would be great. Then days later, he backed out of that. And I've tweeted this, and it's very simple. We ought to know what's going to happen. We don't want to wait for an IG inspection or something else to happen. All we have to do is have the Education Committee Chairman David Grosso call in Jenny Niles, the former Deputy Mayor for Education, and ask her a simple question. What happened? Because Jenny Niles, as I understand it, orchestrated the whole paperwork and the whole routine, and just call her in and ask her what happened. We don't need a months-long investigation. Let's get to the answer.
Can I jump in here?
Now we're going to let you in.
Kojo and
well,
Tom.
I'd like
to reintroduce.
Can I please jump in here?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Who is this again?
Now don't mix up Silverberg and Silverman.
I know this is a horrible scheduling.
So here, I was just saying this to Tom before we went on air. So of course we want our public officials to tell the truth. And there's a question of who is telling the truth here. But I will tell you that as a former journalist, I know why the two of you are very interested in this story. And let's call in Deputy Mayor Niles, and we got to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, if you were writing your loose lips column, you'd probably been saying the
same
thing.
And this is where, and yes, people should tell the truth, but we need to keep our focus on what really matters here. Why are parents so angry? Because we don't have an education system that is the great equalizer, what public education should be. We have a game of chance. And that's what really angers parents, is that unless you buy into a neighborhood where you have somewhat of a guarantee that your child is going to have a good educational experience, we have a lottery. We have a game of chance. It is a pick four number whether your child is going to have a great educational experience or not. And that the chancellor broke his own rule and was able to circumvent the lottery, and that angers parents. But I think what the core of it is that we need to have an educational system that serves all of our children, whether you live in Ward 8 or Ward 5 or Ward 3, and we're not there yet. And I think that is that's what we need to keep our focus on. I have to say, all the drama, I've been around D.C. politics. I've been on this show as a reporter. I've been on this show as a budget analyst. Now I'm an elected official. And I want to point out a quote that was in Courtland Malloy's column on Monday, which is Mayor Barry said to Fred Cook, "We were so concerned about economic development that we didn't focus on the schools." Now, in my opinion, schools are economic development. What do companies look for? A trained workforce that's going to be good for their companies. We need to keep our eye on the ball here. We need to close this achievement gap. We can't be distracted. We need to make sure that our classrooms are supportive of our teachers and that they truly create learning environments. And whether we're talking about Prince George's changing grades or in our own system changing attendance records and grades, that can't happen. We have to stop it.
You seem to be suggesting that this controversy is a distraction. Here's what Deborah emails to say. In your lead to today's show, you asked who cares if the mayor knew the school's chancellor had skirted the rules that apply to the rest of us to get his child into a better public school. You call it a distraction. That was satirical. I care, says Deborah. This is a blatant corruption, a public official using his post for personal benefit. How do you think this impacts morale morale among the underlings who are held to following the rules. If the mayor knew about this, she should go. Otherwise, the message had gone out to city employees that we are all not equal under the law and corruption is tolerated. We got a tweet from Latak who said, what a slender Reed Grasso is bowing to pressure from Mayor Bowser and her minions. There's a lot of smoke here. Chances are there's a lot of fire, too. Ask Jenny Niles about the chancellor's daughter's transfer. Who knew? D.C. Council does lousy oversight. Disgusted. And finally, Jim Adams tweets in about the D.C. school scandal. I suspect there are more than a few people in the city, in City Hall, who really don't want to know what's happened.
So I would have to disagree with that. I think there is a lot of interest in making sure that we have honesty, that our public, that public officials have integrity, and truth, and someone here is not telling the truth. I think my concern, I'll be honest, is that we could spend weeks and weeks and weeks with subpoenas and compelling people to testify, and we're not going to focus on what really matters here, which is making sure that we have good learning environments in our classrooms. And I don't want to spend another 20 years of regrets about how we haven't focused on what really matters, and we're going to spend weeks and weeks and weeks trying to compel Jenny Niles to testify. Well, now she is a private citizen. She's no longer a public official. So, you know, will she? And I'm not sure, even if we compel everyone, that we're really going to get to the bottom of this.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the difference between being a reporter or a columnist on the outside looking in and an elected official who is on the inside looking out.
That is true,
let the reporter speak. Or the analyst. I'm not really a reporter anymore.
We do have to move on. So
very quickly.
Sure.
I agree with the aspirational thing. Even Mayor Bowser said all 8 wards for school reform.
Right.
I understand the aspirational aspect, but this, we can walk and chew gum on this. We can do everything that you think needs to be done about schools going forward. But the chancellor, the former chancellor, says the current mayor lied.
Right.
That is not a distraction. That goes to the core of the mayor leading the city. Now, my own reporting and looking into this, there's a great deal of confusion about what the chancellor said or didn't say last fall. It's very confusing. It's entirely possible the mayor did not know until February the 12th. And then she called in Jenny Niles, the deputy mayor for education, who I am told said at that meeting that she had messed up this thing by handling, orchestrating the change of the chancellor's daughter from one school to another. I apologize, but this is a deal. This is not a distraction. This is not a setback for doing more. We can do both, and why not?
So we will do both, Tom. So I want to be clear that this is being investigated. So
the Inspector
General is
investigating. Oh, good. We'll find out in the turn of the century.
And the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability is investigating. And I'm frustrated with the pace of their investigations in the past.
Yeah, but the Board of Ethics is under its own cloud of wrongdoing.
To do the investigation quickly and have that information available for voters. But we also need to address some real serious issues here, Kojo, and I want to spend a moment on it.
I have to spend a moment on it. You called vague at the Board of Ethics.
The nature of this exchange, you should understand, listen, Silverman, will mean that the time we devote to some of the topics that are dear to your heart will get shortchanged.
But this is a topic dear to my heart, but the ethics board is under its own scandal. So we need people to tell the truth and to be honest about what they knew when. I agree completely with you, Tom. But we also need to grapple with these big issues that no one likes to talk about.
We have half of our children
in a public school system. We have half our children in a public charter school system. We don't have an actual complete system. We have parents who feel like they're playing a game of chance, the lottery, with their children's future. But, you know, it's more fun to talk about, well, you know, this he said, she said,
no, this
she
is not
said
fun.
Dispute.
It's fundamental. The mayor is accused of lying about the school chancellor, and she's got to lead the city going forward. I don't see why it's hard for David Grosso, the education committee chairman, to simply call in Jenny Niles. And if she decides not to testify, then we now will know something more about it.
What are we
going to
know?
It's not a distraction.
What What will we know more, Tom? What do you hope to get out of
it? I would like to know who decided to move the chancellor's child from one school to another, and did the mayor know
it? So if Jenny Niles says that she was the one who made that decision,
and the mayor didn't know,
which is what has been said and why she said she resigned,
and that the mayor knew or did not
advance the ball
anymore? Yes, if she says if she knew or if the mayor knew or did not know.
Let me wrap this up with a big question. What, in your view, is the relationship between the integrity of the leadership of D.C. public schools and the problems that we're having with the system, as you describe it, the lottery? If, in fact, the integrity of the leadership is called into question, does that call into question the integrity of the entire system that has been put together here involving the lottery, involving grading, involving
I'm not sure
graduations?
Let me answer what I think is your question, Kojo, which is after I talked to the chancellor. So here I'll explain my decision-making process on this, which is when I immediately heard about this, and I have to tell you, here's how I heard about it, is my email inbox got flooded with parents who were outraged about the chancellor's letter to them explaining what happened. And when I heard about it, I immediately said, this is outrageous. He broke his own rule. But I wanted to give the chancellor a chance to explain to me his thought process here. I have to tell you that after I spoke to the chancellor, I concluded that he was not the right person for this job.
And should we conclude that we need to know whether or not the mayor is lying to the citizen? She says she's not.
I'm moving on.
A very compelling story that she found out in February and was horrified as much as many other people were. And for David Grosso, the Council Education Committee Chairman, to essentially punt this to an IG who has no timetable to get this done, is, I think the council is falling down.
I'm frankly surprised
the chairman
Mr. Grosso has not yet tweeted us. He does that on occasion. Our guest, by the way, is Alyssa Silverman. She's an at-large member of the D.C. Council who is an independent. This week we learned that D.C. voters will be able to vote on a ballot measure increasing the minimum wage for tipped workers. You have supported the idea, which would raise the wage from $3.30 to $15 by 2020. What do you say to people in the business community who think that this would be going too high too quickly? And should I stop tipping if this is passed?
So, Kojo, I think what you just said is my concern, which is it's unclear what is going to be on the ballot right now and how that interacts with what we did. So let me be clear about where we are. So we passed the Fair Wage Act, I think it was called, that would raise the minimum wage, the regular minimum wage, to $15 an hour by 2020. And then it would increase the tip wage to $5 by 2020.
Just for inflation thereafter.
Exactly, Tom. Now, while that happened, this ballot initiative was in court. And so how the ballot initiative interacts with what we did, I'm not sure what the timetable is, for example, to get to $15 an hour. And actually, it would be higher than $15 an hour by 2026. So I have to tell you, yes, I've been supportive of increasing the tip wage because I think that the hospitality industry is one of our high demand sectors, and we have to make sure that it pays a living wage. But I'm unclear exactly how this ballot initiative works. And so as an elected official, I will tell you, I will be trying to understand it. If I don't understand it, I know voters don't understand it. I'm an independent, for example. I'm not even sure I can vote on this because I don't vote in the primary. And I read actually on WAMU's website that I will be able to vote on this. So I think there needs to be a lot more clarity about how this ballot initiative will work.
It does seem to surprise everybody that's now on the ballot. And I have to be careful here. My own son is in the restaurant industry business. And so I don't talk too much about restaurant
issues. Turn off the radio, Peyton, but go ahead.
But it does seem to me this is a nationwide issue. This organization, ROC,
Restaurant Opportunity Center.
Yeah, right. They have done this across the country. There's nearly a dozen states that have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Their argument is a fairly strong argument that says a lot of people in the restaurant tip industry business do not make minimum wage issues. They work for for lower income restaurants. Families come in, they leave a dollar or two for a tip instead of these high-end restaurants where you can make a fortune. So that might, but it seems to me we haven't even had a discussion about this, and now we're supposed to vote on Initiative 77 that would wipe out the tip wage and just go to the minimum wage that we're all going to have. It just seems to me it sure is rushed, and I'm surprised by it.
Well, I think a lot of people are surprised by it. What I'll say is that, you know, I think there are a lot of issues in the hospitality industry. We know, for example, that there's a lot of issues regarding wage theft, which means that people don't get the wages that they deserve in the restaurant industry.
Well, let's be clear what that means. Just people, a customer leaves a tip on a credit card, and somehow or another the owner of the restaurant doesn't transfer it to the worker.
Right. Either they're not getting their tips, or so under our current law, you are, if you work under the tip wage, the law requires that you be paid the minimum wage. We know there are some people who aren't getting paid the minimum wage. You know, there are also issues regarding harassment in the restaurant industry, particularly impacting, I think, women. But my main concern about the ballot initiative is how this is implemented matters. For example, we know that we're going to $5 by 2020, and if this is going to $15 by 2026, then what is the increase every year? That's unclear right now. I don't know if there. I actually tried to look up what is in the ballot on going to be on the ballot. It was hard to find, so I think we need more clarity about how this is going to work.
Odie Donald II, the district's director of employment services, is heading back to his home state of Georgia to be city manager of South Fulton. You have expressed some concern about that. How disruptive is his departure to the city, and in particular to the Department of Employment Services?
So here's where I will put on my former loose lips hat and say that I have now changed all my Google alerts to Skype interview and insert agency head here, Laura Zeilinger, and Skype interview. So it is very disruptive. We need strong, consistent leadership in the Department of Employment Services that's going to be in it for the long haul because we have, you know, a opportunity gap in our city. We have tremendous income inequality in which some people are doing quite well, but some people aren't. And DOES is a key agency to address that issue.
In addition to which, he was responsible for rolling out the district's new paid leave program, which is launching in mid-2020. How do you keep that on track with his sudden departure?
Well, we're going to keep it on. So what I will say to you, Kojo, is that as chair of the Labor and Workforce Development Committee, I have oversight over the paid leave program, and I am going to do my best, everything I can, to keep us on track. But I am concerned about the change in leadership and whether we are going to be able to do that. We have some deadlines in the law that I am concerned we're not going to be able to meet, and it's important that we meet them. By July 2019, we're supposed to have a tax system in place. By July 2020, workers are should be able to access their benefits. I think that we need to keep our focus on this program, making sure that we meet these implementation guidelines. I spoke to Mayor Bowser about this, in fact, yesterday, that I'm concerned that we don't have the infrastructure that we need just right now in place and that we haven't done the nationwide search to fill this these very important positions in the Office of Paid Family Leave. But the mayor said that she is going to work with me and that we will meet these timelines. And I
including,
certainly
believe
her?
Including the launching of the D.C. Infrastructure Academy, which is scheduled to launch this month in Ward 8. What's the status of that right now? Because that goes to the essence of what your concern is about closing the gap between rich and poor in the city. How can people who want employment in the infrastructure through the infrastructure get involved?
So this once again goes to the fact, Kojo, that we need systems. And this is what makes me different as an elected official than as a reporter, my former life as a reporter, in that we don't have a workforce development system right now. I think the infrastructure academy can be a good idea, though I have questions about it. I want to expand it to our high demand industry sectors. For example, healthcare. I just sat down with MedStar, which is one of our biggest private employers in this city. They have not only Washington Hospital Center, but the National Rehabilitation Hospital and Georgetown Hospital. That's a lot of jobs. And when I asked the vice president of MedStar, well, do you work at the Department of Employment Services? No.
They don't do it on summer jobs or anything.
How do you train, you know, how do you plan for your future workforce? Well, I think a lot of their employees come from our neighbors, Montgomery College and Northern Virginia Community College, which has great programs for training people in healthcare jobs. And I just had a hearing of public witnesses on the Department of Employment Services, and we had a great person testify from Capitol Hill Village talking about if we're going to be a city that ages in place, then we're going to need a lot more healthcare workers to help people, including home healthcare aides. So that's all to say that I think we still need to have more of a discussion about what the Infrastructure Academy is going to be. I'd love to see it expand to IT, for example. If we're going to compete for Amazon, then we need to have a workforce development system in place for IT jobs. I would like to see it expand to healthcare. Let me add in one more thing, which is also hospitality. We were talking about that before with the ballot initiative. DC Central Kitchen has been operating in the basement of the CCNV shelter, training so many people, especially folks with barriers to employment who are coming out of prison and need opportunity. They need a 42,000 square foot space to operate in. I'd love to see the Infrastructure Academy include that kind of industrial.
You mentioned Montgomery College and Northern Virginia. Next week, we're going to have the president of the University of the District of Columbia on. He's going to make the argument that you guys are underfunding the university terribly and that the university can probably do a lot of these things if they had the appropriate funding. But Tom Sherwood.
As the council member knows, Department of Employment Services is one of my go-to complaint agencies. It spends tens of millions, maybe $100 million a year, and it lets all these contracts for job training. And they cannot tell you who they've ever trained and how long they've had a job. I think the test is usually if you get a job for 6 months. I thought Odie Donald was going to, in fact, start changing that. We've got summer jobs coming up. I don't have any confidence at all that the Department of Employment Services is doing anything other than paying contractors and themselves. And this is, I know this is a long-term issue that you're addressing,
yes.
And I appreciate it. But it seems to me that we're not getting anything out of this agency where people are, in fact, getting jobs. We had a over in Ward 8, Trayon White, the council member, shut down the Bizzuto project over there because he said
they have 2 minutes left.
They're not hiring. What? They're not hiring people. And the mayor says we're going to have a job fair over there. He says we don't need a job fair. We need jobs.
So
it's all a mess.
What we need are good
systems.
Outcomes. Yes. Well, we need to make sure that for the $150 million that we spend in workforce development, that people are getting jobs in the end, and we're just not training people to train them and have the trainers earn a profit.
They don't they can't tell us how the money gets.
Well, I've been demanding that, Tom. That has been a focus.
Right.
I mean, first of all, we need to know what we're doing now in order to figure out where we're going. And that has been my demand of the agency. To give me outcomes, give me numbers, and if you can't prove that you can't measure what you're doing, then we might be putting our money elsewhere.
Before I get time to talk politics, I'll use this to introduce politics. As of this week, Washington has an affordable housing preservation officer,
yes.
Anna Lopez Van Balen. What exactly is she going to do?
So we need a housing preservation strategy, Kojo. We haven't had one.
We don't have a strategy for anything, apparently.
Well, that's why I agree. We need a strategy. And we can't just say, market forces, we can't throw our hands up and we can't do anything. I disagree. We need to make sure that this is a city in which low and moderate and middle income people can live here. And therefore, we need to have somebody in charge of making sure that if this building is up for sale, Does the district have an interest in keeping it affordable? Yes, then we need to use tools like District Opportunity to Purchase Act, which we have had on the books for 10 years and never used. I have a lot of hope for this preservation officer, Tom, in that I served on this the mayor's housing preservation strike force. This was one of our recommendations. We need someone in charge to set a preservation strategy. We can't just willy-nilly let, you know, this city become unaffordable.
And make sure that she works really hard. But at the same time, there's a hearing next Tuesday, I think at 2 o'clock, where the mayor has proposed significant changes in the comprehensive plan that will make it much more difficult for neighbors or people to fight changes in development in the city. It will make it even easier for developers to build these very expensive properties and with no guarantee that any of it will be affordable.
So I have vowed to everyone that I am going to make sense of the comprehensive plan, because as I said to the director of planning, Eric Shaw, last week, he said, well, in 2006, we put into the comprehensive plan a strategy on displacement. And I said, well, apparently the comprehensive plan must be pretty toothless, because there's been a whole lot of displacement in the past 10 years.
Yes, the deal is, if this passes as the mayor has proposed it, developers, you will not be able to go to court to sue any decisions by the Board of Zoning. It gets very dry in all this discussion.
But the fact is,
your neighborhood people, some of whom would take advantage of this, but others who wanted to protect their neighborhoods, will not be able to do so.
Okay, let's talk politics.
When we talk affordable housing, your former colleague from the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, Ed Lazier, is running for chair of the D.C. City Council.
Who's that?
Ed, a name that may be vaguely familiar to you.
I don't know.
Are you supporting him? Have you endorsed him?
I'm not going to make an endorsement. I have a high regard both for Ed and for Chairman Mendelson. I have my own race to run, which, by the way, if people are interested in supporting me and seeing me on the council for another 4 years, they should go to my website, Alyssa2018.com.
Interrupt. What about the summer job program? Is this going to work? I mean, we've got something like 13,000 kids. In the past, some don't show up and get paid. Some show up and don't get – it's just been a real mess. Do you have any hope that the summer jobs program this summer will work?
So we need for the summer jobs program to work, because
yes.
But as you know, it's been a major focus of mine, not only because I think it's a very important program, but it is also our largest workforce development program. We spend $20 million a year on this program. What I am focused on is making sure that the summer youth employment program focuses on what's called soft skills or life skills. And I see what we're reading about and seeing in reports
This is not loose lips.
See what she's doing.
Thank you very much, Councilman.
She has been a guest as a reporter. She has been a guest when she was with
the
Fiscal Policy Institute. She's
now
a guest as a council member. Bye.
I think I also have the same
we've got a Jack Evans problem
here. Allison Silverberg. I think I get to stay.
Alyssa Silverman is an at-large D.C. council member. She is an independent. Thank you so much for joining us.
And she did call for regards to your mom. To resign. Now you call for the mayor to let us know what happened.
Joining us next is Allison Silverberg. She is the mayor of Alexandria and a candidate for re-election. We already have one call for her. Tom Sherwood, the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University, decided to conduct a poll last week about this year's congressional races and how they're likely to fare in Virginia. And it looks like Democrats seem to be much more enthusiastic about their chances in congressional races. 60% of them said they're very enthusiastic about voting in November. And, well, basically the poll says that it looks like Virginia is likely to become more of a blue state than ever, and that the Democrats are likely to turn out big time for the congressional races. But kind of we already knew that, didn't we?
Well, the Virginian Democrats are still on a high from last year, where they really changed the face of the state government, certainly the General Assembly and the House. But, you know, the Democrats only hold 4 of the 11 congressional seats in the state. Barbara Comstock, the Republican, in 10 is considered in the suburbs, one of the maybe most vulnerable. But the enthusiasm of the Democrats is clear across the board. Whether they can unseat some of the other congressmen in the state, I don't know. But certainly is a big fight in in the 10th district for Barbara Comstock, who's running for re-election. But you know, Tim Kaine is on the ballot. He's the state, the senator, former governor, vice presidential candidate. He's an enthusiastic person to drawing out the voters. People want to come support him. You know, Corey Stewart, the Republican from Prince William County, is one of the leading candidates on the Republican side. That would be one heck of a race. Talk about reporters warning, wishing for a race to happen. You want to see a Tim Kaine, Corey Stewart race. But the Democrats in the state certainly are enthusiastic.
And in the city of Alexandria, where Alison Silberberg is mayor, and she will be a candidate for re-election. She will be on the ballot in June as a Democrat. Are there any Republicans at all in Alexandria?
Yes, there are.
They meet in the phone booth.
I swear.
No, there are, and there are a number of independents as well.
Because there are, at this point, no Republican challengers to you, are they?
That's correct.
That's not her big issue.
What is her big issue?
Mr. Wilson.
Justin Wilson, who will be challenging you in this race, he's running against you. What do you feel is the most significant difference between you and Justin Wilson?
Well, first of all, I'm honored to be with you all. Good to see you again.
Good to see
We're
you.
Exhausted from Melissa Silverman being on. So, so it was good to have Silberman on. All right.
I thought she did very well.
Silverberg as opposed to Silverman.
Right.
Okay,
right,
we got it.
Right. Well, I am running for re-election, and I'm certainly proud of my record. I've been in office as mayor now for just over 2 years, about 2 years and 2 months and 9 days to be exact. And we've been tackling issues that have been festering for years and even decades, and we've been very proactive and getting a lot done as a team, and I'm certainly proud of that. And I am thrilled that we are moving forward with regard to fixing our CSOs. These are the combined sewer.
What does that mean?
Combined sewer outfall.
Thank you very much. Sewage.
It's about sewage.
Thank you.
And in addition to that, other infrastructure issues that have certainly been festering. We've been repaving roads, over 130 lane miles in 2 years. We've been we voted for 2 schools in 1 year. That's a first in the city's history. There have been years in the past that went by where they didn't even vote for a school. So we've been doing so much in such a little amount of time.
Now, what is where the big difference issue is, with you and Justin?
Well, I've certainly continue to want us to pursue thoughtful, appropriate development that fits in and is to scale.
I'd like to interrupt for a second,
yes,
because
sir.
Florence in Alexandria has been waiting since the beginning of this broadcast to ask you about your approach to development, so allow me to have her join the conversation. Florence, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. First of all, this is a wonderful show, so I have been listening from the beginning very loudly. Okay, I love it. And hello, Kojo. But this is Florence King. I'm a longtime resident of Alexandria, and I have a little statement, but then it's followed by
Please make the statement very brief, because we're running out of time and we don't want to cheat Alison Silberberg.
Okay, this is quick. This is quick. Okay, so first of all, happy birthday, Alison. I think you're a fellow Piscean. Is that correct?
That's correct. Today's my birthday.
You've used up half of your time already.
Okay.
Thank you.
My question is, because, you know, Alexandria is rapidly becoming a destination, so my question is, what could you give a few views on your own thoughtful and appropriate development in Alexandria? Because we have some people who want development, and then you have others who want to keep that old town feel.
How do you get development and keep that small town, old town feel?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Florence, and thank you, Coach. So, first of all, we are a city of great neighborhoods. And I'm fully committed to doing all that we can to protect our neighborhoods. That means that when we develop, that we should have it fit in and be to scale. That means that we should honor what we say we're going to do and reach out to the community and also listen to the people. I'm certainly a promoter of much more civic engagement and have done everything I can to make sure that the people are heard. We're there. It's a government of the people, for the people, by the people, and for the people, but always for the people. And so when they come forward, when there's a development process that comes forward and doesn't make sense to 99% of the neighbors in that community, I think that we should listen. That was the case just recently off of Seminary Road with something known as the Carrig Estates. And while it had been adjusted over time, it still didn't it still would have had a very negative impact on the environment there, and a major geologist had weighed in. And I felt strongly that the neighbors should have been listened to, that the project could have been moved much farther, closer to the main road and away from the ravine and the stream. The Potomac Yard vote, where there's a building being proposed across the street from some townhomes that are about 40 feet tall, and they were told originally that the master plan said that they'd have another set of homes, probably, 40 homes, and then suddenly they realized that the same company that built their homes was proposing a set of buildings to be a building with a set of units right across from them, like 40 or 50 feet away from them, but it would be actually like 70 feet tall and almost 380% increase in density. So I just think we owe it to the people to do a lot more outreach, to it's not like
your supporters feel that is your major advantage, that you listen to people. Your opponents feel that may be your major flaw, that you spend too much time listening to people, in so much time that you don't really get things done as quickly as they would like.
And well, that's very interesting, but I think, with all due respect to that point, I think we're getting a ton done. We're getting so much done that's been festering for years and decades. And so I don't think that that's actually accurate. I like to deal in facts. Look at the fact of what we have done in just 2 years, basically. In 2 years, we've been taking on the CSO issue. We're going to get that done and get it done right. We've been pushing for funding from either federal help or state help. We've been focused on the schools a lot, which we should be. That's another issue. Our population, the school population, has grown since 2008 by 48%. That's amazing.
Glad you raised that, because Sean emails, will Alexandria get a new public high school soon? What about putting one in the space where the Landmark Mall is now?
Well, Landmark Mall is about a 50-acre site and is owned by, in part, by Howard Hughes Corporation and Seritage, which is really Sears. And there is a process, and we have a plan for a mixed-use property there, so development. So I think it's going to be tremendous when it's done, and we're working on it very hard and very proactively. But let me just answer one. If I could just say
ahead,
to his
quickly.
Point really quickly, that when you said, you know, I take too much time, we should be listening to the people. It's the people's city. And second of all, I am careful and I'm measured with my words, and I set the tone for the city, and I think that's what we want for our mayor in our city. And I'm not a person who creates a Twitter war, if you will. So I am very careful and measured, and I think that's what we want. And, of course, I was not the one who reduced the amount of speakers that would speak at open mic.
That was Justin Wilson.
Let's be clear. I don't think anybody is wanting to cut off the citizens. I haven't found that anywhere in any jurisdiction I've been where the issue is how much you've done it to the extent that things don't get done, because it's like a listening society as opposed to an action society. But you and Mr. Wilson can fight that out.
Well,
the overall issue, as I was reading over about Alexandria from the Alexandria Times and other places and its study about taxes, is that increasingly Alexandria is an unaffordable city, that residential properties have gone up in significant value for taxes, while commercial property has gone down the tax assessment. So that means the homeowners are paying more, residential owners are paying more for the operation of the city than the commercial aspect. And some people are saying that Alexandria must have some reasonable development to bring in more corporate taxes, or you're going to have a situation where the homeowners pay more and more and more of the operation of the city government. And that's the argument against your listening tour where you spend too much time listening to what people want to do and not making faster decisions, because this is a fast-moving economy, and it's getting to be unaffordable to live in Alexandria, whether it's affordable housing or whatever.
Well, to that point, I think that we have been extremely proactive and knocking things out of the park, and nothing in our process has changed while I've been the mayor. The only thing that has changed is that at the beginning of a public hearing, which is only once a month, the residents are restricted to 15 speakers at the beginning now. And it used to be for 40 years or more that it would sometimes be three speakers, but sometimes would be more. It just depended on how many people came. So nothing in the process has changed. So that's a fact. Second, as far as the commercial imbalance, I think that's an excellent point. So this has been a longstanding issue, I'm certainly very pro-business. We have a lot of great things happening. We're in the top 20 for consideration, frankly, for Amazon. As you know, that's now public.
Sean emails, has the city of Alexandria incentivized Amazon to put its HQ2 inside city limits?
Actually, over 200 cities put their hat in the ring.
Have you made public what your offer is? You know, the city has not made public its offer. You know, Maryland hasn't.
Right. So it's a great question. The answer is that in order to participate in this, we're not allowed to speak about anything specifically at this point. So there's a strict confidentiality rule that's applied by Amazon. So I need to honor that. But the National Science Foundation is just open. We just got named this past week by Money Magazine as the number one travel destination in the country. I'm very proud of that, and we have a great city. Historic preservation is a core value, and people come from all over the country, all over the world.
Look, can we go back to the housing?
Go back to the commercial?
I want to go back to housing, part because the Alexandria Times this week, and I think it's this week, in an editorial, says that over the last 18 years, Alexandria has lost something like 16,000-17,000 affordable units of housing, and that it is a, quote, a stain on the city government that more has not been done to make workforce affordable housing in Alexandria, and that you're becoming just either rich or wholly subsidized people.
Where do you think the funding for affordable housing should come from?
And you and the proposal
question
and
do I answer
for
first?
Well, part of the proposal is that you suggested that you change to raise money for affordable housing by rounding up restaurant bills to the nearest dollar and use the additional money from wherever that is to fund affordable housing. Others have said there ought to be a 1% sales tax or some type of tax levied to provide money for affordable housing. But in any event, something should be done.
Something should be done, and I've said many times that I believe strongly that we should have dedicated funding for affordable housing. I've been focused on affordable and workforce housing for probably 20 or more years. And
have you been successful? I mean,
yes. Well, hold on one second. So from the year 2003 to 2012, in that decade, we went from about 18,000 market rate affordable housing units down to below, I would guess, 5,000. So we lost about 12,000 market rate affordable housing units in that decade. And then I was on the council as vice mayor. And then we lost some more. We slowed the rate,
right.
but we are now working much more with nonprofit developers, and we have some new buildings coming online. Now, this is different from public housing, of course. That's the housing authority's work. We're talking about workforce and affordable housing, 60% AMI, et cetera, and I'm fully in favor of this. And wherever we need to look at all the options for a dedicated funding stream. We already have 0.6 cents for the Affordable Housing Fund as a set-aside. But there was a while there in 2013 when it was removed, and I fought to reinstate that 0.6 cents, that dedicated funding, and we were able as a council to put it back in. But it, in my opinion, it really needs to go back to being a penny, because that's what it originally was. And then second is that whether it's whatever it is, whatever one of these options is, I think that this council has shown great courage to focus and being dedicated to affordable workforce housing. And I'm certainly committed to doing one of these proposals The voluntary contribution, rounding up, if I could, rounding
you
up.
You have 2 minutes okay, and 52 seconds left.
All right, rounding up for affordable housing might garner, based on our calculations, 70% more than the meals tax, 1%. And a number of restaurants have weighed in and said that they're very concerned about it. There needs to be dedicated funding.
But it would be voluntary. If I'm dining in one of your fine restaurant establishments and my bill is 52 cents, well,
I'm in favor of doing something.
How do I raise it up to a dollar? Do you have to ask each time?
It would be on the little bit. It would be on your piece of paper, and it's voluntary. But look, if it would raise more, I think it's worth exploring. Then we'd get more affordable housing and workforce housing units. But if the meals tax is appropriate in terms, I'm asking the community to weigh in and share their thoughts. Let's just get it done.
We got a tweet from someone who says that what Ms. Silverberg said about the city cutting off the voice of the people is accurate. The mayor is the only person on the council that does listen. But here now is Laura in Alexandria. Laura, you have less than a minute, but go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you so much. No, Mayor Silverberg, happy birthday, first of all. Secondly, I want to congratulate you on the coalitions that you've built in the city around the issues of seniors, around the issues of the religious leaders. You're a big proponent of public-private partnerships. I'm wondering, in what areas, what's an area that we need to tackle in the city where you can also apply that skill of bringing people with, you know, diverse interests together and having them, you know, solve a problem?
In 1 minute or less.
Well, thank you. There's so much that we can do together. I definitely want to encourage the voice of the Federation of Civic Associations. I've also announced that I'll be opening up my office for anyone to come meet with me for 10 minutes. The first one's going to be March 26th.
Excuse me, you're going to have a limit on your own visitors of 10 minutes? That's what the council wanted to do.
No. Let me finish. No. It's any number. No.
30
it's
seconds.
They get 3 minutes each, but only 15 speakers. And I said that should be unlimited for open mic.
Alison Silverberg is the mayor of Alexandria and a candidate for re-election.
No, it's
she
unlimited
is a Democrat.
That day, Tom.
Alison Silverberg is today indeed.
It's unlimited.
Is today indeed your birthday?
Yes, sir.
Well, happy birthday to you.
And
good luck to you. Tom
ethics.
Sherwood is our resident analyst.
We
He's a contributing writer for the Washington City Paper. Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Inga-Lisa Schroepsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Rachel Sedone, and Diana Mostock. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Our intern is Julie Deppenbrock. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.